bears only the mention of two major unpublished orchestral works, a piano concerto and a concerto grosso for cello. Written towards the end of his life, an unpublished trio for flute, viola, and harp, nicknamed Arrowhead, suggests a new, spare, and compact approach to chamber composition. Following an involuntary hiatus of 16 years, Zeisel returned to Job and brought to the composition of Act II increased expressivity and technical mastery. Switches of scene are more abrupt. The set piece is in turn more savage, more tender, more sensuous than anything in Act I. Ensembles are more frequent and more assured. Appropriately climaxing Zeisel's years of struggle with counterpoint is the closing scene of Act II, in which the entire cast combines variously to mock Mendel's plight or to sympathize with it. The contrapuntal texture ceases dramatically at Mendel's decision to go to America. In a coda, the motif of Menuhin's song promises redemption, while the chorus pronounces Mendel's fate to wander. With the exception of two scenes performed in makeshift fashion for a composer's workshop, the completed portion of Job has never been heard. What of Zeisel in the years he was composing this and his other Jewish works? He left the movie industry and secured positions as instructor of theory and composition, first at the Southern California School of Music, then by the fall of 1949 at Los Angeles City College. Between institutional and private teaching, he earned enough to support his family and have some free time for composition. Performances were more frequent. Recognition of his achievements grew significantly. On the occasion of his 50th birthday, commemorative articles appeared in America and Austria. A group of his friends formed a committee to organize a concert in his honor. Included were Stravinsky, Mio, Schoenberg's Widow, Korngold, Alma Mahler Werfel, Toch, Fritz Wey, Pyatigorsky, Adler, Tansman, and John Vincent. The Gala Festival concert took place May 22, 1955, with Curtis Stearns conducting the Beach City Symphony. The lovingly prepared program included representative samples for each period of Zeisel's life. On January 9, 1957, Zeisel was honored in observance of Jewish Music Month. As part of the workshop devoted to his music, the composer was to present the message from the conscious Jewish composer. Alas, this provocative title is only that. The notes Eric had jotted on cards have vanished. The workshop began late, and Zeisel spoke but a single sentence before being cut off. The gauge of his growing recognition is the number of summer stipends, commissions, and fellowships received in his last years. Examples include commissions by the Interfaith Forum, the Los Angeles Chamber Symphony, the New York Chamber Music Society, and the New York Art Foundation. Of inestimable importance are the summers spent at the Brandeis Camp as composer in residence. Here, free for once from outside pressures, and in an atmosphere conditioned by Judge Brandeis' philosophy of national and religious consciousness, Eric was able to explore the compositional path he had chosen. Grants from the Huntington Hartford Foundation in 1957 and 1958 allowed him to resume work on Job. In a beautiful natural setting and surrounded by a stimulating company of artists, Eric could concentrate fully on the creation of what is unquestionably his masterpiece. On February 18, 1959, Zeisel collapsed and died in the halls of Los Angeles City College. Condolences poured in from the musical world, from his committee of friends, of course, also from Emmett Laverie, who had once offered Zeisel the opportunity to set the story that later became in Poulenc's hands, The Dialogue of the Carmelites, Marta Feuchtwanger, William Steinberg, Carl Bamberger, and a host of others. Included are his childhood friends, such as Hilda Spiel, and his longtime librettist, Hans Kafka. Far more significant than this cold list of names is the warmth contained in their messages. Eric was indeed dearly loved and sorely missed. Perhaps Stravinsky's letter says it best. Personally, Eric Zeisel's death gives us deep anguish. He was such a good man, so full of enthusiasm. There remains position four, a hypothetical one to be sure. Zeisel is an international composer using American elements and American subject matter. Although the life had ended, the case history must continue because Zeisel had numerous exciting plans on the drawing board at the time of his return. closer to the incorporation of American music and subject matter in his by now international style. First, there is the projected completion of Job. Kafka's libretto for Acts 3 and 4 exists. It is known, too, that Eric asked his students to collect examples of American ragtime. The reason is simple. Acts 3 and 4 are set in America. The stage directions and the text of the opening street scene capture the flavor of New York through the perception of its immigrant population. Let us project ourselves backward in time to the Bronx of 1917. Imagine, if you will, a lower middle class street inhabited by various nationalities. To the left is an Italian fruit and vegetable stand, to the right, a Chinese laundry. In the center stands Saul Shapiro's Music City. Playing in the street are children of all nationalities. To the ragtime blaring from Mr. Shapiro's establishment, the children dance and sing the following. When one dances to the ragtime, everybody dances it. Yankees, Irish, Hawaiians, Southerners, Republicans, Poles, Swedes, Democrats, Catholics, Asians, the Canadians and the British, Italians, Israelites, Czechs and Mohammedans, Giants and Lilliputians. For when it comes to the dance, they are all Americans. Second, there exists a fascinating correspondence between Zeisel and the great literary figure Leon Feuchtwanger. Zeisel asks Feuchtwanger to consider adapting his play, The Devil in Boston, to the dictates of the operatic stage. In typically direct fashion, Zeisel writes, "I need crowd scenes, trial scenes, execution scenes, everything mystic, imaginary, and in contrast, all strongly realistic, like scenes for the people. Love scenes and everything religious are very good. All prayers should remain, ballads, folk dances, big action. Politics reduced to the purely emotional root element is good. Love of country, love of freedom is an expression of the people, revolt against tyranny." The figure of Coleman is not realizable musically, and for that reason perhaps completely superfluous. His arguments can be advanced by others. On the other hand, Richard and Abigail could be drawn in much more detail. Are you very disgusted with me? Although Feuchtwanger was unable to comply personally with Zeisel's request, he was interested sufficiently in the project to suggest as a potential librettist the writer Victor Clement. Until the composer's death, negotiations continued through correspondence that amounts to a credo of Zeisel's opera aesthetic. Two further operatic plans concern purely American subjects as developed by American authors. First, Zeisel was in correspondence with the American cartoonist Crockett Johnson about the possibility of an operatic adaptation of Johnson's successful comic strip, Barnaby. Finally, Zeisel was deeply moved by Charles Loomis's charming short story based on Indian legend, The Man Who Married the Moon. A typescript of the story exists, and Zeisel made efforts to find a suitable librettist. Here, then, in sketchy overview, is the case history of Eric Zeisel, the transplanted composer. In every direction lie fascinating avenues for investigation. Yet, Zeisel today is a neglected figure in the history of 20th century music. The reasons are all too evident. Born in 1905, he was younger than his friends Toch, born 1887, and Korngold, born 1897. Thus, a lasting reputation had not quite been secured in Europe when the spread of Nazism forced him to leave. The politically motivated cancellation of Leon Szilena was for Zeisel an artistic disaster. Then, 20 years later, death occurred just as he was finally attaining wide recognition in America. He founded no compositional school. Although he was, from all evidence, an outstanding and inspiring teacher, he had no great disciple to perpetuate his name. His music appeared on only two commercial recordings. His unique compositional style worked against him. Too dissonant for adherence of the Romantic tradition, the same style was branded overly conservative, too tonally oriented by the adherence of atonality. Most damaging, Zeisel never achieved permanent affiliation with a major publishing house. Twice he came close. In Europe, Schott was interested. On the surface, Schott's letter to its Viennese representative appears innocent enough. Unfortunately, it reads in part, "Considering the present economic situation, we are not in a position to promote the doubtlessly very talented and interesting manuscripts by Zeisel." The date reveals the camouflage, February 16, 1933. In America, Associated Music Publishers issued an attractive brochure, here it is, announcing the acquisition of Eric's works, when Zeiss moved west, publication plans quietly expired. Some works were published, of course, by Universal and Doblinger in Europe, by J. Fisher, Bills, and Transcontinental in America. Still, an inordinately large amount of publishable material lies in manuscript, until recently inaccessible to scholars, teachers, and performers. Three quarters of his songs, many of his finest choral works, his major orchestral works, and all of his dramatic works, the core of his creation in short. In conclusion, the individual Zeissel, both in his achievement and in his relative obscurity, stands for many composers of the emigre community. The time has come for broader studies of their contributions, and indeed, notable strides are being made in this direction. More specifically, Zeissel's life and music are subjects worthy of study in their own right. His life story alone contains the stuff of which novels are made. Concerning his music and papers, much work remains to be done. Here is original material for scholars, theorists, teachers, publishers, and performers. There exist autographs, copyist scores, sketchbooks, working drafts, scrapbooks, correspondence, and related materials. There exist the finished products, most of them in manuscript, solidly crafted, technically challenging, and almost invariably pleasing to audiences. The great beneficiary from further research endeavors will be the musical public. Just as Zeissel adopted America and enriched America's music, so rediscovery of Zeissel's legacy must come from America. Not only are the materials here, there is a final irony to report. A decade following the composer's death, attempts to organize a memorial concert in his native Vienna failed. Prospective sponsors were advised to contact the Austrian-American Society. For Austrians, in short, Zeissel had become an American composer. Thank you. Welcome to look at that, and then please have a cup of coffee, something to eat with us before we go out.